group of American poets in the same class is rather severely limited to two. I refer, of course, to John Berryman and Robert Lowell. But Ted Hughes is younger by a full literary generation than either Berryman or Lowell may suggest something of what this numbers game might look like in another 10 years. The roster of his major collections reads like a what's been happening in British poetry since the publication of The Hawk in the Rain in 1957. That volume was succeeded by Lupercal in 1960, in 1967 by Wadwoe, and just recently, the American edition was published this week by Crow. Taken successively, the four books mark an increase in power, and perhaps more importantly, in risk. The control was there from the beginning, unmatched by any living poets but Berryman and Lowell. In addition to the poems, Ted Hughes has written short stories, radio and TV dramas, and some of the best children's books around. He's won most of the available prizes on both sides of the Atlantic, which I'll spare him rehearsing. I'm grateful and pleased that Colgate was included in this brief reading tour of America. Welcome in the March snow to Ted Hughes.
I read for about 45 minutes. About a fox, which is not a fox, which I call a thought fox, and which was to be a real fox, which was to be just a descriptive account of meeting a fox, and then got sidetracked, as poems do when you try to corner them, into this. I imagine this midnight moment's forest. Something else is alive beside the clock's loneliness, and this blank page where my fingers move. Through the window I see no star, something more near, though deep within darkness, is entering the loneliness. Cold, delicately as the dark snow, a fox's nose touches twig, leaf, two eyes serve a movement that now and again now and now and now sets neat prints into the snow between trees, and warily a lame shadow lags by stump and in hollow of a body that is bold to come across clearings, an eye, a widening, deepening greenness, brilliantly, concentratedly coming about its own business. Till with a sudden sharp hot stink of fox, it enters the dark hole of the head. The window is starless still. The clock ticks. The page is printed. Is that near enough? And then, read one out of each book, and then I'll read a few from a series of poems that I've just published. This one is called Hawk Roosting, and this is just the monologue of a bird sitting in a wood, this hawk sitting in a wood. And all the information he's ever had is from himself. He's no precepts, no precedents, no experience of any kind, but what comes from inside himself. And so he thinks, as every animal and bird and being in this situation thinks, that he's nature itself. And I was taxed once that this, in fact, is obviously the muse of a fascist dictator of a particularly unscrupulous kind, such as Hitler or Stalin or so on. But in fact, what I meant was this, not a dictator, not even a god, but a kind of goddess who is happens to be male. A little bit of both. I sit in the top of the wood, my eyes closed. Inaction, no falsifying dream between my hooked head and hooked feet. Or in sleep, rehearse perfect kills and eat. The convenience of the high trees. The air's buoyancy and the sun's ray are of advantage to me, and the earth's face upward for my inspection. My feet are locked upon the rough bark. It took the whole of creation to produce my foot, my each feather. Now I hold creation in my foot, or fly up and revolve it all slowly. I kill where I please because it is all mine. There is no sophistry in my body. My manners are tearing off heads, the allotment of death. But the one path of my flight is direct through the bones of the living. No arguments assert my right. The sun is behind me. Nothing has changed since I began. My eye has permitted no change. I am going to keep things like this. And I'll read on request. This is just a portrait of a neighbor when I lived in a colliery town in South Yorkshire. And next door we had this family. And he was a coal worker, a face worker in the mine. And there's a sort of necessary battle goes on between all colliers and their wives. This women lead a despised existence in the colliery ethos. And it's just a portrait of it. And it was set out, and actually is a short story, and I boiled it down and cut it down, and less seemed essential. And I finally got it down to this, which seemed to be the one incident which typified everything else. I just call it her husband. Her husband comes home, dull with coal dust, deliberately to grime the sink and foul towels, and let her learn with scrubbing brush and scrubbing board the stubborn character of money. And let her learn through what kind of dust he has earned his thirst and the right to quench it, and what sweat he has exchanged for his money and the blood weight of money. He'll humble her with new light on her obligations. The fried woody chip, kept warm 2 hours in the oven, are only part of her answer. Hearing the rest, he slams them to the fire back and is away around the house end singing "Come Back to Sorrento" in a voice of resounding corrugated iron. Her back has bunched into a hump as an insult, for they will have their rights. Their jurors are to be assembled from the little crumbs of soot. Their brief goes straight up to heaven, and nothing more is heard of it. I wrote a long series of lectures One lecture for each faculty in an ideal university. And each lecture, each syllabus reduced to one lecture, and each lecture reduced to 12 lines. So the whole course took about half an hour. This is a theology lecture. No, the serpent did not seduce Eve to the apple. All that's simply corruption of the facts. Adam ate the apple. Eve ate Adam. The serpent ate Eve. This is the dark intestine. The serpent, meanwhile, sleeps his meal off in paradise, smiling to hear God's querulous calling. This one is a gloss on a story, which you may know. It's called The Kreutzer Sonata, which is a story by Tolstoy, and which is the same story as Othello, more or less, and which is the same story as a remove of the situation in Tolstoy's own life at about the time. And the situation was that Tolstoy was becoming very gradually, decade by decade, or 5 year by 5 year, more and more puritanical. And Tolstoy, who started as a complete animal, very proud of his prowess in every direction, he used to take on entire brothels, I suppose. And by the time he was 41, 42, he was beginning to have doubts. By the time he was 50, he was thinking that the whole thing was a mistake, and that one would far better commit your energies to God and so on. And this meant that, in fact, he turned against his own nature, which meant, in fact, that he turned against everything that he produced. So he wanted to destroy his writings. This came on him frequently, destroy the lot. And then again, maybe he thought he should go on producing so that he could make immense royalties, so that he could hand them over to puritanical sects, which is what he did with the royalties of, I think, Anna Karenina. He gave them to the Duke of Boers to come to America. And the Duke of Boers was such an extreme Puritan sect that they, to them, the body itself was a crocodile, and the main element in it was the serpent inside a crocodile, which was the Satan inside a serpent, and was the devil. And so after producing one child, just to perpetuate their principles, they would shave themselves downwards and downwards and downwards, and then take everything off. Slice everything off. And that was the end of it. And this, Tolstoy thought, was the ideal solution, which he didn't quite have the courage for. So he gave them the royalties, and they came to America. Anyway, this took the shape of a little myth in Tolstoy's mind, like Othello, because the same thing was happening to Shakespeare. And in this story, the wife has this close friendship with a musician. And there are several places in Tolstoy where music appears as the voice of the devil. And the protagonist, the teller of the story, becomes intensely jealous of his probably quite innocent relationship, and eventually to the point where he breaks in on their little duet with a Turkish dagger, and he kills not his wife, who you'd think would be the one he resented, but this that's completely wrong, of course. He killed not the musician. with his wife. Not at all a joke. Just as Othello killed not Cassio, but Desdemona. Anyway. And the idea was, you see, that he was killing his works himself. It's a story of a suicide. Anyway, this is a... So I just address the poem to him, and the idea behind it is that the real motive of Puritanism is of energy of sexuality that the owner cannot bear, and so he just cuts it off. It's too much. And also, he doesn't want anybody else to be enjoying. So I address it to Tolstoy, and I mix up quotations from Othello. Now you have stabbed her good, a flower of unknown color, appallingly blackened by your surplus of bile, blooms wetly on her dress. Your mystery, your mystery. All facts, with all absence of facts, exhale as the wound there drinks its roots and breathes them to nothing. Vile copulation, vile, etc. But now your dagger has outdone everybody's. Say goodbye, for your wife's sweet flesh goes off. Booty of the envious spirits, assault. A sacrifice, not a murder. 140 pounds of excellent devil for God. She tormented, demented you with that fat lizard Trukhachevsky, that fiddling, leering penis. Yet why should you castrate yourself to be rid of them both? Now you have stabbed her good, Trukhachevsky is cut off from any further operation on you. And she can find nobody else. Rest in peace, Tolstoy. It must have taken supernatural greed to need to corner all the meat in the world, even from your own hunger. This one is a short little description of a little girl looking at the full moon. A little two-year-old girl with just a few words. One of her words and her favorite word being moon. And as you know, when a child learns a word, all they seem to see is what that word indicates. So everything becomes moon or apple or bottle. And then comes the moment when they actually see the moon in perfect setting, which is what happened here. And the full moon, as you know, rises at dusk in opposition to the sun. And this is set in the west of England, and you imagine a lush sort of west of England scene, evening. A cool, small evening, shrunk to a dog bark and the clank of a bucket. All right. A cool, small evening, shrunk to a dog bark and the clank of a bucket. And you listening. A spider's web, tense for the dew's touch. A pail lifted, still and brimming. Mirror to tempt a first star to a tremor. Cows are going home in the lane there, looping the hedges with their warm wreaths of breath. A dark river of blood, many boulders balancing unspilled milk. Moon, you cry suddenly. Moon, moon. The moon has stepped back like an artist gazing amazed at the work that points at him amazed. These are from a long series of poems, which are really the verse parts of a story. And the story, roughly, begins in heaven, and where God is having a nightmare. And nightly, or whenever God falls asleep, this nightmare comes out of the distance as a hand, just a disembodied hand, an enormous hand. And this hand is also a voice, both a voice and a hand. And this hand gets hold of him by the throat, crushes his throttle and lifts him up by the neck and squeezes his neck till the vertebrae separate, and hangs him out and shakes him out and pushes him out beyond the furthest star and shakes him and brings him back and grinds his face into the earth and plows the earth with his face, brings him back and throws him down. And every time he falls asleep, this is what happens. Until he no longer dare go to sleep. And so God is sitting in heaven exhausted from lack of sleep and wondering how to bring this voice to speak and to explain itself and to tell him how he can help. And he can't imagine how there can be anything in his creation, entire, everything, that could be so unknown to him as to do this sort of thing to him. And he cannot imagine that there could be anything that he doesn't have complete control over and hasn't created and measured to the last. And finally, he manages to get this voice to speak, to appear, or at least to make itself heard and to speak, and they're able to converse. And the voice is full of mockery, mocks God's creation, mocks his prime creation, man, most of all. He's got it in for man. And God becomes more and more indignant and more on his dignity. And finally, various other things happening help this along. He challenges the voice to do better. And this is what the voice has been trying to arrange. And so the voice then, with this permission, plunges down into matter and disappears. And God thinks he's solved the problem. The voice says he's called the bluff for the nightmare. And then out down in the creation appears this thing. And God realizes that the voice has made something. And so he comes back down into his creation to see what it is the voice can possibly have made, and to try it out and to inspect it and watch it and generally weigh it up and test its possibilities. And so he comes down and he discovers that its potential is tremendous and frightening. And so he begins to be friendly and to lead the voice along and to lead it into temptation and to oppose the voice, and becomes more and more anxious and fights the voice, and more ridiculous situations develop, until finally God gets eaten. And then this thing, which is called by everything that sees him and by everything that speaks to him, he's called Crow. Actually, he doesn't know what he is. He carries on from one thing to another. Things continue to happen even though he's eaten God. And so anyway, these are verses from along this story. And everything that happens has several legends, contradictory legends. And whatever Crow meets, sings to him. And whatever he meets, he sings to him. So there's always this quarrel of songs going on too. Anyway, before he can get born, he has to be born into matter, you see. And so he has to find some womb to get born out of, as in the best precedent. But before he can get out, he has to pass an exam. And the questions as follows, and his answers. This is his completed sort of Viva Voce exam, anyway. So there are two voices, little dialogue of his exam, examination at the womb door. Who owns these scrawny little feet? Death. Who owns this bristly, scorched-looking face? Death. Who owns these still-working lungs? Death. Who owns this utility coat of muscles? Death. Who owns these unspeakable guts? Death. Who owns these questionable brains? Death. All this messy blood? Death. These minimum efficiency eyes? Death. This wicked little tongue? Death. This occasional wakefulness? Death. Given, stolen, or held pending trial? Held. Who owns the whole rainy, stony earth? Death. Who owns all of space? Death. Who is stronger than hope? Death. Who is stronger than the will? Death. Stronger than love? Death. Stronger than life? Death. But who is stronger than death? Me, evidently. Pass, Crow. He works with God here and there, and God's going through everything all the time, repeatedly. It's a perpetual performance, creation. And so this is... there's a Talmudic story that God, having made man's and woman's bodies beautifully modeled out of all the select earth and clay and waters from all over the earth, and there they lay in this beautiful paradise, dead. And he... fashion the souls, summon the souls, call the souls to go into them. And the souls refused to enter the bodies. And they just stayed out into the gulf, crying and hugging each other. And he called them into the bodies. And they refused to enter the bodies. And for 500 years they stayed out in the gulf and wouldn't enter the bodies because they knew what was waiting for them. And this situation again perpetuated. And Crow comes along, and Crow has a short cut. Crow gets them straight in. Or he improvises a soul, which works better. Man's and woman's bodies lay without souls, dully gaping, foolishly staring, inert, on the flowers of Eden. God pondered. The problem was so great, it dragged him asleep. Crow laughed. He bit the worm, God's only son, into two writhing halves. He stuffed into man the tail half with the wounded end hanging out. He stuffed the head half, head first, into woman. And it crept in deeper and up to peer out through her eyes, calling its tail half to join up quickly, quickly, because, oh, it was painful. Man awoke, being dragged across the grass. Woman awoke to see him coming. Neither knew what had happened. God went on sleeping. Crow went on laughing. A lesson. God tried to teach Crow how to talk. Love, said God. Say love. Crow gaped, and a white shark crashed into the sea and went rolling downwards, discovering its own death. No, no, said God. Say love. Now try it. Love. Crow gaped, and a blue fly, a tsetse, a mosquito zoomed out and down to their sundry flesh pots. A final try, said God. Now, love. Crow convulsed, gaped, retched, and man's bodiless, prodigious head bulbed out onto the earth with swiveling eyes, jabbering protest, and Crow retched again before God could stop him, and woman's vulva dropped over man's neck and tightened. The two struggled together on the grass. God struggled to part them, cursed, wept. Crow flew guiltily off. This one is called a grin. One of his songs, you see, or his recitations in some episode. There was this hidden grin. It wanted a permanent home. It tried faces in their forgetful moments. The face, for instance, of a woman pushing a baby out between her legs, but that didn't last long. The face of a man so preoccupied with a flying steel in the instant of the car crash, he left his face to itself. That was even shorter. The face of a machine gunner, a long burst, not long enough. And the face of a steeplejack the second before he hit the paving. The faces of two lovers in the seconds they got so far into each other they forgot each other completely. That was okay, but none of it lasted. So the grin tried the face of somebody lost in sobbing. The murderous face and the racking moments of the man smashing everything he could reach and had strength to smash before he went beyond his body. It tried the face in the electric chair to get a tenure in eternal death, but that too relaxed. The grin sank back, temporarily nonplussed, into the skull. It's called Crow's Vanity. Looking close in the evil mirror, Crow saw mistings of civilizations, towers, gardens, battles. He wiped the glass. But there came mistings of skyscrapers, webs of cities steaming the glass. He wiped it. There came spread of swamp ferns fronded on the mistings, a trickling spider. He wiped the glass. He peered for a glimpse of the usual grinning face. But it was no good. He was breathing too heavy and too hot, and space was too cold. And here came the misty ballerinas, the burning gulfs, the hanging gardens. It was eerie. This is a horrible religious error. He makes various mistakes. And in this, he nearly becomes a Christian. When the serpent emerged, earth boweled brown from the hatched atom, with its alibi self twisted around it, lifting a long neck and balancing that death and mineral stare, the sphinx of the final fact. And flexing on that double flame flicker tongue, a syllable like the rustling of the spheres, God's grimace writhed, belief in the furnace. And man's and woman's knees melted. They collapsed, their neck muscles melted, their brows bumped to the ground, their tears evacuated visibly. They whispered, "Your will is our peace. But Crow only peered, then took a step or two forward, grabbed this creature by the slack skin net, beat the hell out of it, and ate it. Conjuring in heaven. So finally, there was nothing. It was put inside nothing. Nothing was added to it. And to prove it didn't exist, squashed flat as nothing with nothing. Chopped up with a nothing, shaken in a nothing, turned completely inside out and scattered over nothing. So everybody saw that it was nothing. And that nothing more could be done with it. And so it was dropped. Prolonged applause in heaven. It hit the ground and broke open. There lay Crow, cataleptic. It's called Crow's Undersong. This is, he meets an owl, among other things, and tries to remember what the owl sang to him. He sang how the swan blanched forever, how the wolf threw away its telltale heart, and the stars dropped their pretense, the air gave up appearances, water went deliberately numb, the rock surrendered its last hope, and cold died beyond knowledge. He sang how everything had nothing more to lose, then sat still with fear, seeing the claw track of star, hearing the wing beat of rock, and his own singing. He goes to various plays, whatever is going on, and he goes to see a performance of Oedipus by Seneca, which is a particular version of Oedipus, and he sees that Seneca had it wrong, and of course he's read Freud, and he knows that, now realizes that Freud also had it wrong, and so he reads everything else and he realizes that everybody had it wrong. And so he's asked to say what was right. And so this was what he made of it. There was a boy, it was Oedipus, stuck in his mammy's belly. His daddy'd walled the exit up, he was a horrible fella. Mamma, mamma. You stay in there, his daddy cried. Because a dicky bird has told the world, when you get born, you treat me like a turd. Mamma, mamma. His mammy swelled and wept and swelled. With a bang, he busted out. His daddy stropped his hacker when he heard that baby shout. Mamma, mamma. Oh, do not chop his winkle off, his mammy cried with horror. Think of the joy will come of it tomorrow and tomorrow. Mamma, mamma. But daddy had the word from God. He took that howling brat, he tied its legs in crooked knots and threw it to the cat. Mamma, mamma. But Oedipus, he had the luck, for when he hit the ground, he bounced up like a jack-in-a-box and knocked his daddy down. Mamma, mamma. He hit his daddy such a whack, stone dead his daddy fell. His cry went straight to God above, his ghost, it went to hell. Mamma, mamma. The dicky bird came to Oedipus. You murderous little Todd. The Sphinx will bite your bollocks off. This order comes from God. Mama, mama. The Sphinx, she waved her legs at him and opened wide her maw. Oedipus stood stiff and wept at the dreadful thing he saw. Mama, mama. He stood there on his crooked leg. The Sphinx began to bawl. 4 legs, 3 legs, 2 legs, 1 leg. Who goes on them all? Mama, mama. Oedipus took an axe and split the Sphinx from top to bottom. The answers aren't in me, he cried. Maybe your guts have got them. Mama, mama. And out there came 10,000 ghosts, all in their rotten bodies, crying, you will never know what a cruel bastard God is. Mama, mama. Next came out his daddy dead and shrieked about the place. He stabs his mammy in the guts and smiles into her face. Mama, mama. Then out his mammy came herself. The blood poured from her bucket. What you can't understand, she cried, you sleep on it or sing to it. Mama, mama. Oedipus raised his axe again. The world is dark, he cried. The world is dark, 1 inch ahead. What's on the other side? Mama, mama. He split his mammy like a melon. He was drenched with gore. He found himself curled up inside as if he had never been born. Mama, mama. When he looks back and he sees what happened in the early days, he sees that it happened differently to what he had thought. And so he gives better accounts of it. And this is one of them, called Apple Tragedy. So on the seventh day, the serpent rested. God came up to him. I've invented a new game, he said. The serpent stared in surprise at this interloper. But God said, you see this apple? I squeeze it and look, cider. The serpent had a good drink and curled up into a question mark. Adam drank and said, be my God. Eve drank and opened her legs and called to the cockeyed serpent and gave him a wild time. God ran and told Adam, who in drunken rage tried to hang himself in the orchard. The serpent tried to explain, crying, stop, but drink was splitting his syllable. And Eve started screeching, rape, rape, and stamping on his head. Now, whenever the snake appears, she screeches, here it comes again, help, help. Then Adam smashes a chair on its head, and God says, I am well pleased, and everything goes to hell. This one is, do you think you could be still? Yeah, it's a bit distracting, just for a minute. I keep looking over at you. This is Crow in the Sea. This is the account of his friendship for the sea. He tried ignoring the sea. But it was bigger than death, just as it was bigger than life. He tried talking to the sea, but his brain shuddered, and his eyes winced from it as from open flame. He tried sympathy for the sea, but it shouldered him off, as a dead thing shoulders you off. He tried hating the sea, but instantly felt like a scrutty, dry rabbit dropping on the windy cliff. He tried just being in the same world as the sea, but his lungs were not deep enough, and his cheery blood banged off it like a water drop off a hot stove. Finally, he turned his back and he marched away from the sea. as a crucified man cannot move. There's one of the early stones by which one of the early texts in two or three languages of the Middle East, which enabled them first of all to decipher the otherwise completely uncrackable codes of language, was a sort of statement from, obviously from some hermetic religion. And the text of it has become basic to all magical traditions. But it was also, happened to be the stone, having two of the ancient texts, the text of it in two ancient languages and in Greek, so they were able to translate backwards. Anyway, this is one of its derivations. So I call this fragment of an ancient tablet. Above, the well-known lips, delicately downed. Below, beard between thighs. Above her brow, the notable casket of gems. Below, the belly with its blood knot. Above, many a painful frown. Below, the ticking bomb of the future. Above, her perfect teeth with the hint of a fang at the corner. Below, the millstones of two worlds. Above, a word and a sigh. Below, gouts of blood and babies. Above, the face, shaped like a perfect heart. Below, the heart's torn face. As he goes along, he comes to a river. A wide and heavy river. And sitting beside this river is an enormous woman. And this woman seems to be, at first he just takes her for a great heap of offal and rubbish and whatnot, and then it moves. And it turns out to be a woman. And this woman, one means and another, coerces him into carrying her across this river. So he finally gets her aboard and staggers into this river. And her legs around his neck, and he's getting into the deep water, and suddenly her weight, which is already enormous, begins to increase and increase until he has to stop, and it goes on increasing and drives his 2 feet down into the bed of the river, and so the water comes up and up and up, and as the water reaches his mouth, she asks him a question, and he has to answer this question immediately and as quickly as possible and as accurately as possible. And being a crow, he makes no elaborations about it. He just answers it just as a crow would. And all right, satisfied, weight lightens again. She becomes more or less natural. He's able to pull his feet out of these great pits, stagger on a little bit further. And then her weight begins to increase again and drive him down into the bed of the river again, and so on until the water comes up. And again, she asks a question, and he answers it as he can. And this happens 7 times across the river. And each time, because he's desperate, he answers dead accurately. And so he manages to get her across the river. He gets her to the 7th question, and the 7th question he fails, actually. But he manages to get across the river with a trick later on, but that's of no concern here. It's, this is one of his answers to one of the questions. I forget what the question was, but this is his answer. You've got to imagine the water. and that he's only a crow. He loved her and she loved him. His kisses sucked out her whole past and future, or tried to. He had no other appetite. She bit him, she gnawed him, she sucked. She wanted him complete inside her, safe and sure forever and ever. Their little cries fluttered into the curtains. Her eyes wanted nothing to get away. Her looks nailed down his hands, his wrists, his elbows. He gripped her hard so that life should not drag her from that moment. He wanted all future to cease. He wanted to topple with his arms around her, off that moment's brink and into nothing or everlasting or whatever there was. Her embrace was an immense press to print him into her bones. His smiles were the garrets of a fairy palace where the real world would never come. Her smiles were spider bites, so he would lie still till she felt hungry. His words were occupying armies. Her laughs were an assassin's attempts. His looks were bullets, daggers of revenge. Her glances were ghosts in the corner with horrible secrets. His whispers were whips and jackboots. Her kisses were lawyers steadily writing. His caresses were the last hooks of a castaway. Her love tricks were the grinding of locks. And their deep cries crawled over the floors like an animal dragging a great trap. His promises were the surgeon's gag. Her promises took the top off his skull, she would get a brooch made of it. His vows pulled out all her sinews, he showed her how to make a love knot. Her vows put his eyes in formalin at the back of her secret drawer. Their screams stuck in the wall. Their heads fell apart into sleep, like the two halves of a lopped melon, but love is hard to stop. In their entwined sleep, they exchanged arms and legs. In their dreams, their brains took each other hostage. In the morning, they wore each other's face. He writes various epics, lyrics, novels, plays. And this is one of his plays, notes for one of his plays. Because so much is going on, he never gets beyond the notes for anything. So this is just his outline to be treated of later in his creation. And this is, all his plays only have two characters. And they're usually the same characters. And this is one of them. Just notes. First, the sun coming closer, growing by the minute. Next, clothes torn off. Without a goodbye, faces and eyes evaporate. Brains evaporate. Hands, arms, legs, feet, head and neck, chest and belly vanish with all the rubbish of the earth. And the flame fills all space. The demolition is total, except for two strange items remaining in the flames. Two survivors moving in the flames blindly. Mutations at home in the nuclear glare. Horrors, hairy and slobbery, glossy and raw. They sniff towards each other in the emptiness. They fasten together. They seem to be eating each other, but they are not eating each other. They do not know what else to do. They have begun to dance a strange dance. And this is the marriage of these simple creatures, celebrated here in the darkness of the sun, without guest or God. Also, two more. He meets, as he goes, an Eskimo. And this Eskimo, it becomes his guide. This Eskimo knows how to live. And this Eskimo is teaching this character how to live. And his teaching consists of a lot of stories and legends and songs. And he gives him spirits. As you know, Eskimos are defended by numerous spirits. and without deprived of these spirits and they simply die as anybody else would under the conditions they live in. So if you turn an Eskimo into a Christian and send him back into the north, he just dies. But if you send him back as an Eskimo with all his spirits intact, he's happy. And so the Eskimo is a sort of master of this technique. Now this is one of the songs that he gives to the crow. O little blood, hiding from the mountains in the mountains, wounded by stars and leaking shadow, eating the medical earth. O little blood, little boneless, little skinless, plowing with a linnet's carcass, reaping the wind and threshing the stones. O little blood, drumming in a cow's skull, dancing with a gnat's feet, with an elephant's nose, with a crocodile's tail, grown so wise, grown so terrible, sucking death's moldy piss. Sit on my finger, sing in my ear, O little blood. This is one of the stories he tells him, called, he explains the whole universe in stories. And this is one called How Water Began to Play. Water wanted to live. It went to the sun, it came weeping back. Water wanted to live. It went to the trees, they burned, it came weeping back. They rotted, it came weeping back. Water wanted to live. It went to the flowers, they crumpled, it came weeping back. It wanted to live. It went to the womb, it met blood, it came weeping back. It went to the womb, it met knife, it came weeping back. It went to the womb, it met maggot and rottenness. It came weeping back, it wanted to die. It went to time, it went through the stone door. It came weeping back. It went searching through all space for nothingness. It came weeping back, it wanted to die. Till it had no weeping left. It lay at the bottom of all things. Utterly worn out, utterly clear. Thank you.